over the last day and a half, we've heard from elected officials and are in our communities, and they're a group that is difficult to get to the table, and just raise the awareness with them. There's this assumption that that the response organizations are just going to solve their problem and they don't have to worry about it until sometimes it hits them in the face. And
yeah,
I think getting them to the table and getting them, maybe not the level of training that we do for responders, but some level of awareness, so that they, I think it also helps them understand that their communities have a level of risk.
Yeah.
And that when you're considering funding options, that making sure that your responders have the right tools and equipment and are trained properly can help.
Welcome to the Environmental Transformation Podcast, where we talk with industry leaders, climate champions, and sustainability professionals who are making an impact in their businesses today. Each leader is solving complex challenges and providing solutions within their respective areas of expertise. And here's our host, Sean Grady.
Hello, ET Nation. It's time to spread the word about this podcast. If you're just tuning in for the first time, well, welcome. We are honored to have you here with us. Please take a moment and subscribe to the podcast and leave a review about this episode. If you are a longtime listener, well, thank you. If you haven't gone to my website lately, please sign up for our newsletter, blog posts, and email announcements. And do it now. Go to www.seankgrady.com. That's www.seankgrady.com. And become a member of the ET Nation today. We look forward to having you join us. Welcome to the Environmental Transformation Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Grady, and today's guest is Bill Schoonover. He is the Associate Administrator of the Hazardous Material Safety for the Pipeline and Hazardous Material Safety Administration in Washington, D.C., PHMSA, and he has safety oversight. He previously served as the Deputy Associate Administrator of Field Operations, leading PHMSA's comprehensive oversight program, including enforcement, special investigations, outreach and engagement, investigator training, through PHMSA's 5 regional offices and the coordination of activities with modal partners. He's been in the business for over 35 years, and he's an expert in the field. And he is one of the leaders that are supporting the inaugural Rail Thought Leaders Summit here in Addison, Texas. And Bill, thank you for coming on the show and organizing this with Skip Elliott and others. Really appreciate you coming.
Great. Thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me here.
Tell us how you organized the summit, this Railroad Summit of Thought Leaders, and what are the outcomes you hope to achieve by bringing all these thought leaders to Addison? So,
I have to say, I had the easy job of this.
Okay. So
all I had to do was find a way to fund the summit and allow people to come together and put their great thoughts down on paper. So I really can't take a lot of the credit for the paper that was developed, but you know, I will take credit for finding a way to fund the collaboration of people to come together. And you know, I'm just super excited with the folks that are here.
Well, the turnout's been impressive. We've got over 80 thought leaders in the industry, I think representing about 40 different states, I think is what I heard. A combined, I don't know, what, 1,500 years of experience or something like that.
Absolutely.
That's in the room collectively. Super impressive. And the kudos to the Hammer Group, Hammer Training Group that's come in from DOE to help organize this. They've done a fantastic job. And just all the stakeholders that are represented, it has been super impressive.
Yeah, I think this is the first grouping that I've seen where we've had people come to the table that traditionally have not been here. And I think that's for me, one of the impressive parts of it. You know, it's easy to get the fire service and the government and the railroads together. It's a little harder to bring in elected officials, you know, the public safety access points, you know, a lot of other people who want a seat at the table, but don't always know how to get there. And we still have a long way to go.
Right.
We have some folks that aren't at the table that we really need to figure out how to engage those. And I'm sure we'll talk about that as we.
Well, yeah, I think that was one of the kind of interesting observations, should I say, of all the different stakeholders that have come to this representing their piece of the emergency response industry. I didn't really know all the people that were involved personally. So, you know, firefighters, emergency responders, the class one railroads, like you said, certain, maybe some local government, but you don't really think about everybody. And a lot more people are here and they make you think like, well, they have a different perspective of why they're here. And not, it's different than what I'm thinking why I'm here. And I think that's what's really come out of it, is you're starting to get appreciation for other people's perspective.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you think about somebody from the public works department, they don't think about a hazmat incident or their role in it.
Right.
And yet they're going to be called to it. Public health service. You know, what do people in the hospitals do? They're worried about dealing with their sick people every day and helping their community. And they're not thinking about, what do you do in a mass trauma event? And, you know, when I talk about public works, when an incident occurs, how do we bring the environment back? You know, what's that back half of it to make sure that we put it back the way it was, so that we are in fact addressing it. And they have a role in that. They have a role in overseeing it. And oftentimes they're the ones that know what it was like before. So.
Yeah, I think part of the white paper, as I started to read it, I was looking through it and I was trying to do some research on, you know, PHMSA's role as well, and you know, how they interact within this whole picture. And one of the things I saw recently noted by PHMSA was that the number one violation found during inspections was failure of training hazmat employees or failure for maintaining training records based on hazmat material regulation. Why do you think that's so difficult for both employers and employees to do that?
Well, I think it's, well, the record keeping is always
a challenge.
It's always a challenge. We do a great job of, if we do a great job of training, then we don't always get the records right. You know, it's a paperwork problem. I think what we find is people generally do a good job of basic awareness training. They do a good job of safety training. Mm-hmm. They almost, you know, the ones that we see problems with are function specific. So it's really easy to take something off the shelf and teach somebody how to understand placards and shipping papers and things like that, and how to be safe generally. It's a little harder to teach somebody the specific actions that they have to do. And there aren't things for how do you properly close a drum? How do you, you know, how do you load a tank car? Or things like that. So that's the big area. And that's really, you know, if you're going to have a problem, that's really the foundation for
where it's going to happen.
Doing it safely. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Well, for the listeners, what is the main objective or role for PHMSA in, say, an emergency hazmat response situation?
So we're an investigative agency. Our primary role is ensuring that the 1.2 million shipments of hazardous materials that go into, out of, and through the country every day are transported safely, and they go from their origin to their destination without a problem. We have a kind of a dual charter, if you will. That first one is making sure hazmat is shipped safely. The second side of the charter is when an incident occurs, making sure responders are prepared. And so we do that through our grants. We do that through developing training curriculums for responders. And that's a daunting task. You know, we're not really the response community, so telling them how they should train.
Yeah.
It's in our requirements, but we have to do that in conference with others. So we collaborate with the U.S. Fire Administration and other agencies to try to really help guide that process.
ET Nation, thanks for tuning in. We'll be right back after this message. Hey, listeners, if you're looking for a drilling and an environmental contracting firm to help you delineate the extent of contamination at your site, well, look no further than Cascade Environmental. They are the only field services contractor with the personnel and equipment needed to work with you from project conception to completion. Cascade has over 37 offices across the country and offers a huge range of environmental and geotechnical drilling, site characterization, and remediation services. Thanks to their technical expertise, huge fleet of equipment, and nationwide coverage, Cascade is a great choice to support your environmental and infrastructure project needs. To learn more, check them out at www.cascade-env.com. That's www.cascade-env.com. So I think one aha moment for me coming to the conference and learning more about what FEMSA does is all of the grants that you provide funding for various activities for companies to do and deliver this type of training or to do certain things with that meet the guidelines of your grant opportunities. And I thought, okay, can you talk a little bit about what that looks like for somebody to, you know, maybe consider reaching out to FEMSA to be funded to support, you know, this type of work?
Sure. So a large portion of our grants go to states and they provide the transportation portion of the EPGRA program.
Okay.
So we fund the community planning, training, the drills, and then we also, those funds go to states to fund responder training. Then there are other grants that go to not-for-profits and to employer organizations that provide training to hazmat transport workers.
Okay.
And so if somebody is interested in that, particularly not-for-profits, they can always contact us. We've got a great website. I say it's great. Others tell me it's a little harder to navigate. It's like any government website.
But
we have a grants page.
Okay.
And we're pretty easy to contact, and we would we love to talk to people about how we can get the money out there and really reach groups that we aren't reaching now.
Mm.
There's always gaps to fill in training.
So did a lot of money come to you in some of the new bills that were passed by the infrastructure bill and things like that to help these types of opportunities?
We run a pretty austere program. It's been for my 10 years in 12 years now in FEMSA, it's been about $28 million, $20.3 million a year.
Okay.
We just recently in the appropriations bill and in the bipartisan infrastructure law got the authorization to increase our grants program up to $46 million. We're in the process of figuring out how we're going to collect the money to fund that because it is done. Those fees, all our grants are funded through registration of hazmat shippers and carriers.
Okay.
So if you're a hazmat shipper or a carrier, you pay a fee to us based on whether you're a small business or you're not a small business. And we use that funding and we give all that money out to
responders and training institutions and states to kind of keep up. Okay. That's a good way. I see. I understand. That's good. I think that as you look at the trainings that are out there, is there enough training guidelines or templates or curriculum, you know, blueprints to maybe simplify the process a bit? Because it seems like there's a lot of people doing it a little bit differently, but somewhat consistent or similar, but enough of nuances that it's not always the same. Is there a way to maybe standardize some of this a little bit?
So that's part of the discussion here at the summit,
right?
Is how do we take all these varieties of training, and you're right that there are very different levels. There's everything from the what I would call a marketing type training, where come out and we're going to show you the basics.
Yeah,
you know, probably have some a meal with us, and you know the railroads do this quite a bit, where they bring the safety train in, and it's a show about the equipment you're likely to see,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily the in-depth hazmat training that you might get with a fire training program. So there's varying levels, but all of those serve a purpose. All of those provide training to get people to the table. And there is a lot of room for us to figure out consistency. I hope it's done more organically than the government stepping in and
saying, this is what you ought to do. Yeah. Make it more, like you said, organic and/or voluntary type, collaboratively. Do you think we need more federal and state involvement and oversight in preparing training for hazmat, or is the community already well trained, or should I say knowledgeable about what needs to be trained on, and there doesn't really need to be additional oversight support?
I think that there is a lot. There's a good cadre of people around the country that are knowledgeable about hazardous materials transportation and deeply care about planning and training. I don't know that we have to have more training. I think getting more people into the training. I think there's opportunities where we are, there's gaps where we're missing the opportunity to bring people on board. You know, I think over the last day and a half, we've heard from elected officials and in our communities, and they're a group that is difficult to get to the table, and just raise the awareness with them. There's this assumption that that the response organizations are just going to solve their problem and they don't have to worry about it until sometimes it hits them in the face. And
yeah,
I think getting them to the table and getting them, maybe not the level of training that we do for responders, but some level of awareness so that they, I think it also helps them understand that their communities have a level of risk.
Yeah.
And that when you're considering funding options, that making sure that your responders have the right tools and equipment and are trained properly can help.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Environmental Transformation Podcast. We'll be right back after this message. This episode is sponsored by Zappa Stewart, the leading provider of superabsorbent polymer technology in the power, dredging, oil and gas, and remediation sectors for over 20 years. When a reliable, fast, and cost-effective liquid waste solidification solution is needed, customers count on the ZappaZorb brand of SAPs and Zappa Stewart's technical expertise to ensure a smooth and successful project. When liquid waste needs to be out of sight and out of mind, solidify with ZappaZorb SAPs. To learn more about Zappa Stewart and the super absorbent polymers they offer, visit their website at www.chasecorp.com/Zappa-Stewart.
It seems to be one of the themes I heard is that a lot of states who receive funding, they like to spend the money on a lot of equipment, and they don't spend as much of the money as they get on training of their staff, more versus buying equipment for the staff. And maybe that needs to be kind of, you know, that ratio of what you can use money for might need to be tweaked a little bit. At least it seemed to be a concern to one state official recently, and when they were looking at funding they were receiving from federal government, that they were spending a lot more on equipment versus actual training of people. And I got to imagine that there may be some more opportunities to improve that.
There are. We work, we give out grants and our FEMA colleagues give out grants. So there's different buckets of grants.
Yeah.
So we're doing the HVP grants. Our FEMA colleagues do the safer grants and the other types of grants. And much of the equipment gets bought from the safer grants. Our grants allow the states to buy equipment only if it supports training.
Yeah.
So as long as they're supporting training and using it for training, we're okay with it. We really prefer, and we work closely with them to make sure that the money does go for training responders and making sure that they're prepared.
You know, one of the, I think, ER emergency response type challenges is getting a hold of, say, somebody's emergency response plan from a facility spill or a railroad spill or something like that. And I think you and I touched on it a while back, but, you know, having an actual central repository for documents, is there any thought to PHMSA or some other federal agency to, you know, there's a requirement to put these plans together, but then it's like they get sent somewhere or put on the shelf or they get sent to a local LAPC, but if they're not, you know, reviewing them and going over them quite often, or in the emergency, they go, oh, I don't know where that's at. And then they can't find it. What if it's available digitally, electronically at a local? Is that something you guys, you know, PHMSA has thought about? Or
so we have, after the East Palestine accident, we issued a safety advisory that recommended that railroads, while we weren't considering regulatory requirements to force them to provide them, when they developed these plans, we recommended that railroads consider sharing those plans with local emergency planning committees, with the state commissions, and even local communities, and using those with them as part of the drills and the preparedness exercises. Because it's with seven class one or six class one railroads now, and 500 short lines, I think the class one railroads are pretty, it's a pretty easy solution.
Yeah.
They could put those online. They could share them. They actually train about those. Short lines might be a little more difficult.
More challenging. Yeah.
But certainly making sure they're in the hands of responders and LEPCs so that they are, and emergency managers so that they're incorporated into the thought process.
Oh, that's good. So if you could, for the listeners, Bill, what are some of the intended or, I guess, ideal outcomes you're expecting to see from this summit?
Wow. So I think some might say I have low expectations, but I think I have high expectations. And I say that because my expectations coming out of this and my measure of success is if we can get the participants talking to each other. And that talking carries on beyond this summit. And while some may say, well, that's a low expectation, it is a very high expectation. You know, when you think about it at first, you might say, well, you're not asking for much. But to get people to talk, I really feel strongly that develops, there's an organic nature to solutions that I've seen in my time with the government, that if you bring people together and they talk and listen to each other, they often find ways to meet the needs.
Right.
And so there will be, I think I've already heard of these people with these aha moments saying, hey, that's a great idea. We should talk about this. We should try this. And so there are some great connections that we're forming, and I think there'll be some neat things coming out.
And we'll be right back after this brief message from our sponsor. This podcast is sponsored by the Alliance of Hazardous Material Professionals. As the premier membership association devoted to the professional advancement of hazardous material management, the AHMP membership includes thousands of the nation's leading experts in the environmental health and safety, sustainability, and security management field. The AHMP envisions a world where the earth is unburdened by pollution, everyone has a healthy and safe work environment, and hazardous materials are used and transported safely and efficiently. Their mission is to support their community by listening to its members, exchanging industry knowledge, providing education for its hazardous material professionals, and making our world a safe and healthier place to live. If you want to learn more about the AHMP and become a member, go to www.ahmpnet.org. That's www.ahmpnet.org.
I think, too, one of the opportunities that come out of these breakout sessions that have all been kind of strategically set up amongst the various attendees here, because what's been, I think, genius is that each breakout session and group is made up of a diverse group of stakeholders. And I'm sure that was probably planned, but if not, it was a great, happenstance. But yeah. And I think what that turned out to be is breaking down the barriers and everyone's kind of understanding of the overall situation. And I think we mentioned this earlier, you and I talk and said, this is a really complex situation and issue. It's not just, hey, just get more training and that's all you need to do. It's more complex than that, right?
Yeah,
absolutely. To have emergency response people ready.
Yeah. It's interesting because when I talked to the writers, when they first gave us the report, I looked at it and I said, well, you're asking a lot of questions. And when you bring people together to consider these questions, be prepared because they're going to ask more questions. And that's because no matter who we are, and I have to say that the panel of writers are some of the foremost experts on that topic of preparedness and response. And even with the 120 plus questions they asked, I still found people came in here and said, well,
what about this?
How does this work? I mean, and so that's another benefit of this is you have this brain trust that comes in and really starts to add other perspectives to a very complex problem.
Yeah.
There's 120 issues that cover everything from training to certification to the
stakeholder engagement, incident command,
to planning, you name it. Absolutely. Right. There's a lot of parts to this. And it just shows that there's no one thing we can do. There's a lot of small things that when you put them together, they're going to fundamentally move us forward. So.
I think what I also took away is the appreciation that everyone here seems to be really invested. Yeah. They all are wanting to do the right thing, solve the problems, up their game, level up, and the good corporate citizens, so to speak, in the industry, right? I mean, everyone's, I think, feels like they're pulling in the right direction. They're just going about that in certain different speeds, little different directions, similar process. And one of the things I heard was from one of the class ones, this is the first time there's ever been an actual thought leadership summit like this, where so many of the overall stakeholders that are involved in these types of situations are actually here. It's never been done before. That's pretty impressive. Kudos to you guys to do this.
Thank you. I'm impressed by it. I have to say my director of outreach, Aaron Mitchell, and the Hammer team really did a phenomenal job. And it is traditionally the Hazmat Roundtable, which has been mentioned in the discussion, is really the industry association and the association representatives. It's not the individual players in this. And so we do have some of the top leadership in hazmat response and planning. And you know, getting them together and having them talk is interesting. I often wonder what would happen if we had everybody bring one person they were mentoring that's an up-and-coming leader. Because one of the things we have here is you've got all the leaders, but with the leaders, they're
proteges are not here.
Yeah, we don't have the next generation, and everybody else, we're facing that.
Aging out concept, the gray hair, no hair, you know, scenario, about ready to age out, and where are the younger professionals that are the next level of leaders that are going to take this to the next level? Sure. And I think that should be probably one of those objectives, is to bring them back whenever this resumes. I'm assuming this will resume at some point. I know one of the recommendations from our workshop was that we need to do this again next year, but this time when we do come back, we're going to be talking about all the things that we implemented as a result of the findings and recommendations that we bring up today. And I think that's a really good outcome too, but there's probably another level of planning and decision and strategy associated with this too, as a kind of post-mortem from the conference. What do you think?
Yeah, I know we're going to take all the information we heard, try to figure out where we're going to go. I'm not sure. I hope we're not waiting till next year to do something. I do hope there's some action that comes up rather quick.
Right.
And I do think engaging the next generation and looking, I think there's some solutions here and some ideas that we may not be thinking about because we are the older generation, and we don't necessarily look at technology and the ways that, you know, innovation that's come about that we tend to not.
Social media, getting the message out through social media with the new responders, because what they do, everything on their phones for the most part, they're not going back to the computer.
Yeah.
And so how do you reach them there?
Absolutely. You mentioned, you know, how do we use podcasts to, maybe there's a training aspect where we can provide information out to them. I do think getting the next generation, and then some future activity where we can, I do think, highlighting the successes of this venture and really trying to figure out where we go next. That'll be an interesting.
Well, I'm excited to see what is possible out there. And, you know, for me and in my involvement, I really appreciate Skip and you inviting me to come and actually participate and basically be a platform for a kind of different, you know, level of communication to the industry.
Well, thank you for being here. I'm excited. This is this is someplace we've never done before. And I think this is, you know, we have to think differently. And that's, you know, it's in line with the theme of this summit, is really thinking differently about how we look at the world and we share information and communicate with each other. And this is super cool to be able to do this and really think about getting information out there to people that, you know, are maybe out there and want to be involved, but don't know how.
Right.
And so,
well, what I'd like to do when I'm developing interviews and episodes is, you know, if something strikes my interest, I reach out to them personally and say, hey, would you like to come onto the show and be a guest and come and talk about, you know, your area of expertise or the services you offer or your topic of knowledge, things like that. So in my mind, we could have a lot of conversations in the hazmat community about the challenges or the successes or the programs they put in place or the services they offer, you know, yada, 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 right? And I guess I'm just going to lay out there for the listeners. If you are one of the listeners and you're in this industry, reach out to me. I'll be happy to, you know, set up a meeting with you, talk about what you do and see if there's, you know, we can set up a possible interview and have a good, compelling conversation so we can educate this industry. So with that, Bill, thank you for putting on this thought leadership summit. I think it's going to pay dividends. It's already starting to see some connectivity going on. And I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot of things I didn't know about, you know, how complex this situation is. And so thank you for all the support and all your efforts. So
absolutely. Thank you, Sean. Thanks for being an advocate of this program and all we're doing.
Thank you. Okay.
I want to thank our guest, Bill Schoonover, for coming onto the show today. If you want to learn more about Bill and the work he's doing at PHMSA, check out their website at www.phmsa.dot.gov. We'll also put a link to Bill's contact information on my website. To listen to future environmental transformation podcasts, you can check us out on all the major podcast networks or from my website at www.seankgrady.com. And remember, don't forget to follow us and please write a review about this episode. Also, if you're watching on YouTube, please subscribe to the channel. Well, thanks for listening, and until next time, make a positive impact in someone's life today.